Okay, let's get our Bibles open here to 1 Samuel 30. 1 Samuel chapter 30. My name is Mike Sullivan, by the way. I guess, standing in for Gary. I've lost track with all the rotating teachers we got here. I teach the adult ed classes like principals on Wednesday night and do a few other things up there at the office. Now, I want to get into this passage in 1 Samuel 30, because it hits on this larger issue of success without compromise. And specifically, it gets into the question of how to handle a crisis successfully. I think a lot of people live successful lives, but a lot of times how we handle crisis is really the measure of how things turn out for us. Crises really stretch us. It could be something simple, like when Ohio State lost to Michigan State a couple years ago. Remember that? And they lost their bid to be national champions. If they would have won that game, they would have been national champions. That was a personal crisis for me. I remember driving around just not wanting to listen to the radio anymore because it was so depressing that they lost that game. Or it might be something as common as a fight with your spouse, or maybe something more serious, like losing your job. Or maybe something extreme like a terminal illness or losing a loved one. Whatever it is, crises do really have a way of stretching us, testing us, of really showing what we're made of. The other thing about a crisis that's tough is we rarely see them coming. I was at the circus once as an 11-year-old, and I got peed on by a tiger. I don't know if you've been peed on by a tiger before, but it's a crisis, let me tell you. I went with my friend, and we wanted to go down to ringside before the whole thing started, just to see the animals. I'm walking along, and bam, nailed 10 feet away. And I remember just looking at him and him looking at me. Just, we were in stunned amazement. Just, who would have thought this? And this is the way it is with a crisis. If you would have asked me in the morning when I got up, so Mike, what kind of potential problems might you run into? I might have said I could get hit by a car, my parents, I might get in trouble with them. But getting peed on by a tiger? Nah, it wasn't something I was expecting. And so for us here, as we consider this question of a crisis, the question isn't if you're going to have a crisis, but when. And the more important question is, when that happens, or maybe you're right there right now, are we going to handle that successfully? Because they're not easy to handle. And so we're going to look at this passage here in David's life, 1 Samuel 30. Now, this is before he was a king. And if you remember, towards the end of Saul's life, towards the end of his reign as king, he wanted to kill David. He viewed David as a threat to his throne. And so David was on the run. He gathered a group of men around him, these fighting men, 600 of them. They were these malcontents that he gathered from all corners of the country. And they hung out with him. And they, together with David, were hiding out from Saul in a city called Ziklag, which was a Philistine city. Their homes were there. Everything that David had in the world was in Ziklag, his family, his house, his possessions. And the same was true of all these men with them. Everything they owned was in that city. And when we pick up the story here in 1 Samuel 30, verse 1, they're returning back home from one of their exploits. It says, "It happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag." So this is the southern part of Judea, kind of on the border of the desert. And it says they'd overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone. And they carried them off and went their way. And it says, "When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire. And their wives and sons and daughters had been taken captive." I couldn't imagine. Imagine coming home to a smoldering foundation, to your wives and children gone. Now, it says back here at the bottom of the page here, it says, they took captive the women and all who were in it without killing anyone. It wasn't an act of mercy. Ziklag was on the highway to Egypt. It was It was a highway to the hottest slave trading market in the ancient world. These people were destined to be enslaved for the rest of their lives. And when David showed up with his men, there's no way he could have known who had done it or where his family was. I remember once when I was, it was about a couple years ago, I went into my daughter's bedroom one morning and I looked in her bed and she wasn't there. And I looked quickly around the room, still not there. Went into the hallway, then I went into the bathroom. Maggie? No, not there. I went downstairs, still not there. I went outside, I walked around the house. Maggie! You know, at this point, you know that pit in your stomach you get when you lose a kid in public? You know, that brief moment when you're like at the shopping mall and you, for 5 or 6 seconds you can't find where your little kid went. I mean, I was panicking. I thought someone had kidnapped our daughter. And so I went back upstairs and I looked around more carefully in her room and she was curled up in a beanbag chair over by her window because it was real hot. She was trying to stay cool. But the relief I felt, oh, you're here, thank God. These guys didn't get that kind of relief. There weren't any little kids curled up. They were gone. And it's not surprising that you hear that these guys wept until they had no strength to weep. And what's worse, you know, David barely has time to quit crying when this next thing happens. It says that, moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and daughters. And you can hear what they're saying. You know, David, why did you leave Ziklag without any defenders? We were wide open. We're surrounded by enemies. We all took off. And because of your poor leadership, our children and our family, we're never going to see them again. I don't know about you, but I would call this a crisis. Home destroyed, family kidnapped, friends want to kill you. That qualifies as a crisis in my book. Now, a lot of us handle crises different ways. I mean, think about the last stressful situation you're in. Some of us, we just deal with it by not dealing with it. You know, you'll watch, you'll lay around the house, you'll clean. Even if you don't like to clean, when you're depressed or when it's finals week, your house is spotless because you'll do anything but get ready for that final that you're about to take. Or you think about other people that just like to veg. You know, I'll watch an infomercial. I'll watch The Price is Right when I'm in the middle of a crisis. Anything but to avoid thinking about it. Another way people handle crises is that they lash out at people. They get, you know, they just, you know, spout off at the mouth. I've been on family trips where, you know, I've planned the trip. I paid for it, too. I'm the one who brings the bread home. And we're on the trip, and the weather's bad, and things don't go well, and, you know, people are saying stuff like, why are we here? What is there to do here? Why'd you bring us here? Well, I think I'd rather be at home right now. This is ridiculous. We're wasting our money doing this. And you hear that, and you know, you're in a crisis like that. You're getting criticism like David, and you think, well, if you want a fun trip, then you plan it, you pay for it, and you go on it without me. I don't want to go. And so for David here, I mean, what would have, for me, a couple choice words might have been, look, you don't like my leadership? Fine. My whole family's been destroyed, okay? I'm in the same boat as you are. You made the same decision that I did to leave the city. You don't like my leadership? Screw you. Find another leader. I'm out of here. Ooh, that just would have felt so good to say. And yet, he doesn't. It says instead, and this is characteristic, not always in his life, but many times it says it, like here, it says that David found strength in the Lord his God. Wouldn't that be cool to be in the middle of a crisis, under fire and criticism, and instead of lashing out or instead of ignoring it, to be able to somehow tap into God's strength and rely on that to cope with whatever crisis we're facing? That'd be great. So I want to explore this concept a little bit. Our first tip on how to handle a crisis, strengthening yourself in God. I want to think about this for a little bit. How would it look like, or what would it look like, to actually be a kind of person who can draw strength from God? tell you one thing, and we see this all over in David's life and in the Psalms that he wrote. David knew he was weak. If you're not willing to admit you're weak, if you don't see how needy you are before God, he cannot strengthen you. A lot of us aren't really convinced that we're weak. A lot of us aren't convinced that we need God's strength. And if we don't see that, he can't offer this to us. Look at the language David uses in the Psalms here to describe how much he needs God's strength. He says, "You, O sovereign Lord, you deal well with me for your name's sake. Out of the goodness of your love, deliver me. For I'm poor and needy, and my heart is wounded within me. I fade away like an evening shadow. I'm shaken off like a locust. My knees give way from fasting. My body is thin and gaunt. I'm an object of scorn to my accusers. When they see me, they shake their heads. Help me, O Lord my God. Save me in accordance with your love." Now, this is not a man with a low self-esteem. David was a warrior king, a powerful, good-looking, well-liked, respected, feared person. And yet, when you summarize the things that he talks about, I'm poor and needy. My heart's wounded. I'm like a shadow. I'm here and then I'm gone again. I'm a bug. I'm a bug. I'm a locust. My knees are wobbly, I'm thin, help me, save me. Sounds like a wuss. He's not a wuss. He's somebody who realizes that in comparison to God's resources and to who God is, that he has tremendous need and that he is in a state of weakness. I don't know if this is something that we're comfortable with saying. I'm weak. I don't think that has a very good sound to it. The notion, I need help. I'm desperate here. I need you. I think we hear words like that, and we hear that with disdain. That's weak. It's humiliating to have to crawl on your knees to anybody, God included, and use this type of language. And yet, when we read the Bible, one thing that God demands and insists that we accept as his creatures is this reality that we desperately need him. When God wrote his letters to the churches in Revelations chapter 2 and 3, he had some choice words reserved for some rich, wealthy Christians who lived in Laodicea. I thought it'd be good for us to take a look at this because I think we're in a similar situation. He says in Revelations 3:17, he says, "You say that I'm rich. I have acquired wealth and don't need a thing, but you don't realize that you're wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked." In God's eyes, humanity is in a state of poverty, no matter how wealthy we may feel, a state of need, no matter how in control of things that we feel like we are. I was doing some research on the internet, and it was interesting. They've done a lot of statistics tracking church involvement before and after the September 11th attacks. Barna has, and the Gallup poll has, and they show that in the 10 days after the attacks, church attendance grew by 5%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about how many million Christians there are in this country, 5% is a tremendous number of people. Then they took the same survey in November, and they found out that attendance had dipped right back down to pre-9/11 levels. What's going on there? I think that whole event had a way of lifting the lid off our reality. It really showed how fragile the lifestyle that we enjoy is. And for a brief window, people saw this. They felt this. But you know how it is. We get back into our routine, we get back into the trappings and comforts of our job and our home and our lifestyle, and we forget that we're needy. We forget to be desperate before God. You know, the way it is too, and this is just a sad fact, is many of us, the type A types, the hard-driving, strong-willed types, we're not going to see the fact that we're weak the way God wants us to until he uses some crisis in our life to get our attention. There's a scene in Watchman Nee's book, The Normal Christian Life, where he describes a situation where he was at a camp. He was with 20 other men at this camp, and there were no shower facilities, so they went swimming every day. And one day, one of the men was out swimming in the middle of the river, and he got a leg cramp, and he was having a hard time staying afloat. He started to thrash around. Nee saw that he was in trouble, and he motioned over to this good swimmer that he knew, and he said, "Get out there and save that guy." And the swimmer just ignored him, didn't say anything. Meanwhile, this guy's crying for help, going under here, flailing, flashing, splashing around in the water, and just about to disappear from sight. And finally, this guy that's a strong swimmer gets up and he dives into the water, a couple quick strokes, he finds the guy and brings him back safely to the shore again. And Nee walked over to this good swimmer and he said, "I have never met somebody that loved his life as much as you do. That man could have died. What were you doing there?" And the swimmer just said, "Look, I had to wait until this man was at the end of himself. He had to be completely exhausted and weak for me to be able to help him." And that may be the case with some of us. God's going to have to let us go through something and get to a point where we can't deny the fact that we need him. I just would appeal to you to save yourself the time and save God the trouble and begin to cultivate the habit of admitting this to God, that yes, I need you. There are so many crises that I face that I'm not up for. There's a passage in Hebrews 9, and this is a little bit of a shift from what I'm talking about. It says, it's appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment. According to the Bible, this is the ultimate human crisis that we all face. We're all going to die. We're not going to live forever. And we will all, according to the Bible, come before God and be judged. And that means he's going to evaluate the way we lived, the moral component of our life. Were we good or bad? And the dilemma, the crisis is, we're all bad. Varying degrees of bad, but bad is bad, no matter how many degrees they are. Just think about your relationships. Have you ever hurt anybody? I definitely have. I think everyone in this room would say in unison, yes, I have. That's why it says in Romans, it says that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We have a crisis here. We have a moral, perfect God who's going to evaluate us. And the only way we can face him in light of the way things are in our life is to admit we're weak and to admit we need him. This idea of admitting our weakness to God that I'm talking about, this is what it means to become a Christian. It means going to God and in prayer and saying, "God, you see it, I see it. I can't deny the fact that I've walked away from you and that I've sinned against other people. I've even hurt myself. And I ask for your forgiveness." And what's cool about this is the Bible teaches if we recognize this dilemma and we approach God in humility and in weakness and ask for forgiveness, this is what the next verse says. It says, this is God's response, "Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation," it says there, "without reference to sin, to those who eagerly wait for him." God is willing, if we'll see our weakness, God is willing to overlook it. He's willing to overlook what we've done and take us as is right now, sins and weaknesses included. But of course, we've got to go to him and say, "I need you." And I just would encourage you, if you haven't done that, at any point, this is something you could do today. You could go to God and begin a relationship with him as you are, by admitting your weakness and need. Okay, so that's one of our tips there. Got to know you're weak to be strengthened. Second tip is that David spent time with God. He spent a lot of time with God. If you read the Psalms, There's a book in the middle of the Old Testament filled with these prayers called Psalms or poetic prayers. He wrote about half of them. And if you read these, they're like love letters to God. David cries, he rejoices, he gets angry, he vents, he begs, he asks for forgiveness. He lays all his cards out on the table. And you read that and you walk away and you realize this is a man who spent time with God. David had the habit of taking crises that he was going through and bringing them before God and sitting down with God and hashing out with God, how should I handle this? David spent time with God. I think if you really thought through, and we took a survey here, I bet a lot of us would say that we're not handling crises well. If you think about the last two or three things you've been through. I know I can, and I look at some of those things, and I can honestly say, you know, a lot of times I blow it when I'm going through a crisis. And for many of us, the reason why we're blowing it, a big reason why, is we are not on a regular basis spending the kind of time that we need to with God to be strengthened by Him. This is critical if we want to be prepared for a crisis when it comes up. There's a quote here from a guy named C.J. Vaughan. He's a British theologian. He says, if I wanted to humble anyone, I'd question him about his prayers. I know nothing to compare with this topic for its sorrowful self-confessions. And this is a really hard area to get it together on. I know for me, when I'm in a crisis, once in a while, I'll shoot up a prayer to God. You know, God, this is a drag. All right, now what else am I doing? You know, just a quick prayer, just for a little bit. And then I feel so pressed. I feel like I've got other stuff to do. I don't have time to take a good chunk of my life out to pray. I move on to other things. And I've thought about this from God's perspective. It's got to seem absurd to Him. You know, what if I walked down the hall of my house and I said to my wife, I said, honey, I'm depressed. And then I just walked away. Wouldn't that seem bizarre? I mean, if I was my wife, I'd be like, what? I mean, shouldn't we maybe talk about this? And I feel like we're doing the same thing when in the midst of a crisis, we shoot up a quick prayer of frustration and move on with our life. D.A. Carson said, in the Western world, many of us are praying like nasty little boys who ring the front doorbell and run away before anyone answers. Yeah, David's not that way. You know, David, he rings the bell and he comes in and he takes his coat off and he slips his shoes off and goes into the living room and he sits down on the couch and he visits with God. That's what the Psalms are all about. And that is a key to how in times of crisis like at Ziklag, he drew on God for strength. Now, I got to admit, I know I'm kind of beating myself a little bit up here about my prayer life. I've made some progress here. And I feel like there have been some episodes where I've managed in a crisis to go to God and pray and work it out with Him. I remember one time as an undergraduate in college, I had a heavy course load and I was blowing it big time. I had to teach a Bible study with two or three home churches, smaller churches. I'd never taught to a crowd that big. And I was overwhelmed. I had some conflict going on with my roommates. And I felt like as I looked at my life, I was either failing or in big danger of failing in just about everything I was doing. And I just sat down between the laundry piles in the basement, which if you live with a bunch of guys, those are some pretty gross laundry piles. And I just poured my heart out. I just said, you know, I'm frustrated about this. I got the Bible out. I started to read things to try to sort out my situation. I hashed it out. I remember as I was praying, I felt like God was directing me towards one particular verse in Psalm 40 where God says to David, He says, I will not withhold my compassion from you. And I just broke down right there. I felt like that was exactly what I needed to hear, that God was right there in the room with me. And when I walked out of that basement, my situation wasn't different, but I was different. I was empowered, encouraged. And we can have that It's possible to be strengthened by God like that, but it requires getting before Him, taking time and really talking things through. Now, I know in order to do this, you can't just snap your fingers and be someone who's close with God. I really think it takes a strategy. You've got to come up with a plan for how to do this. I was sitting at a Lee Campbell teaching. He's teaching next week here. He was teaching on loving God, and he quoted this passage that says, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. It's in the Gospels. Like, this is the thing you're supposed to do, is love God. And I sat there and I thought, can I say I'm doing that if I'm not getting regular, contentful time interacting with Him? And I walked out of that teaching and I just thought, I've got to do something here. So I went home and I decided I'd go pray every morning. And so I tried that. I would get up and I'd pray, but every time I got up, my kids got up. I don't know if you've had this. You get up to pray and your kids are awake and you can't pray. So I stayed in my bed. I thought, I'll just stay here and pray silently. That way nobody will be woken up. I won't be interrupted. So I propped myself up on my elbow, prayed, instantly back asleep again. Didn't work. So then I thought, I got to get hardcore here. So I went to the garage and I got a board, a wooden board, and I brought it upstairs and I wedged it between my bed and the wall so I could sit up and lean against it, something uncomfortable. And I finally was able to stay awake and pray and get some quality time in the morning with God. And the point of all this is, if you're going to begin to get a consistent time with the Lord where you're drawing on His strength, you need a plan, and you need to work at that plan. It won't fall into place all at once. We need to get to a point where we can say this is a regular part of what we do, of our relationship with God. We'll have our times when we dip down and don't do it, but this has got to be something that we shoot for. I know a guy at work who goes on a 15-minute walk every day. You know, 9:30, like clockwork. He goes out and he does a loop around the trail here. Can pretty much guarantee he's going to be undisturbed, and that's the way he handles it. Other people, late night. Whatever it is, you got to pick your strategy and run with it. And I want to say, too, before we move on from this point here, from this whole idea of strengthening yourself in God, I know there are people here that are thinking, Mike, that sounds great. Where do I sign up? I'm ready to start. But you're going to walk out of this room, and you're going to forget everything I said, and your life's going to go back the same way it was. And the reason why that is you're not in the middle of a crisis right now, or you don't see one on the horizon. And I would just appeal to you to just think about just the logic of this. Now is the time, right now, to prepare for a crisis. Now is the time to begin developing this ability in your relationship with God so that when the inevitable crisis comes, you'll be in a position to handle it. Okay, well, still kind of got you wondering about what happened to David and his family and the kidnappers, right? Remember them? Let's go back to the story and see what happens. It says here in verse 7 that David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. An ephod's a piece of clothing that priests wear. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band, these raiders that took my family? Shall I overtake them? And this is a simple point, but let's not miss this. What is David doing? Before he decides to handle this crisis, what is he doing here? He is stopping to inquire of God. He's not going to just charge off and deal with this, but he's going to stop first and say, God, what would you have me do about this? And God answers. He says, well, go get them, David. Pursue, for you'll surely overtake them, and you shall surely rescue all. And so he says, here's what he tells David what he wants him to do. And I think this is a simple point, but easy to miss. But key to succeeding in a crisis is that after we've been strengthened by God, we need to ask Him, all right, now what should I do in response to this situation? How should I handle this? You know, after I got peed on by the tiger, the dilemma for me was I really, really, really wanted to see the circus. I'd never been to one before. And My friend wanted to go home and just call it quits and take a shower, which probably made more sense. But I begged him. I was like, come on, let's stay. We'll just clean up afterwards. And so we went to his parents and told them we wanted to stay. And they were like, that's cool. Just sit way over there. We don't want to be around you. But I mean, that's the way, I mean, that is the way I handle things most of the time. Is I've got a crisis. I've got some competing ideas here. I'm just going to think it through, you know, kind of mill it over, and then I'm going to act. And a lot of us, when we run into a difficult time, that is how you function. A lot of us are very capable. We've been through a lot of living. We've handled things. We've just dealt with it. And I just can't emphasize enough how much the Bible warns against that approach to life. The Bible calls us to be skeptical and suspicious of our own solutions to the crises that we're in. In Proverbs, it says in Proverbs 16 that there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end leads to death. Some of the solutions we're mulling over are the worst possible solution to the problems that we're facing. If we want to be successful in the way we handle things when they come up, we've got to learn, like David did here, to inquire of God. And that might mean getting the Bible open and trying to figure out, well, what is God's perspective on a situation like I'm in? Or asking, because the Spirit's inside of us, you know, give me insight here, God, guide me towards, prompt me, you know, lead me towards what you want me to do. Or maybe having the humility to go to a fellow Christian who's mature and say, you know what, I'm kind of blown out of the water by this situation. What's your perspective here? What would you do if you were in my shoes? A lot of us are unwilling to do that because we're too proud to do it. And yet, here in the example of David, we're seeing that this is a critical aspect. Seeking God's will, seeking to inquire of his opinion. This is critical to succeeding in a crisis. Let's keep going then. So there's two. Let's finish up this story. So David, based on the strength he's got from God, and the direction that he got from God in prayer, it says that he goes and he gets the 600 men who are with him, and they came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, it says, he and 400 men, for 200 men who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor remained behind. If you got an NIV, it says the ravine. This is probably a very deep, dry channel, very exhausting to go down and up again. It says that 200 of these guys couldn't make it. It was so exhausting. Let me just explain why this is. Prior to David's 600 men showing up in Ziklag and finding their city destroyed, they had traveled from a city called Aphek all the way down to Ziklag, 50 miles as a crow flies. I don't know how long that is by foot. When they stumbled into Ziklag, they were exhausted. They could barely walk. And then to come and have the emotional trauma of having your whole town destroyed and not knowing where your family is, and then to get your battle gear on and pick up and take off and go chase after the bandits, it's no wonder that 200 of these guys wound up exhausted and unable to go anywhere. You know, they just had to sit down and let the rest of them continue the chase. Well, if you keep reading in 1 Samuel, David and his guys, they run into a drifter. This guy walking around in the desert, and the drifter tells David where the kidnappers went. And so they find the kidnappers, they kill them, they take back their possessions, and they find their women and children. I mean, you can imagine embracing your kid and your wife after something like that. It's a joyous time. But there's one more bump in the road that David runs into here, and one more lesson about handling crisis that we can learn. Let's go ahead and look and see what happens here. Well, first it says, this is important, it says, nothing of theirs was missing. So when they find the bandits, all their possessions are intact, whether small or great, sons or daughter, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves, David brought it all back. So not only do they get their stuff back, but they plunder the spoil of their captors. And then they come back to the 200 men who couldn't make the trip. It says, David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet him and meet the people who were with him, and David approached the people and greeted them. So a happy reunion so far. But then, It says, "Wicked and worthless men among those who went with David answered and said, 'Because these guys didn't go with us, these 200 slackers, we're not going to give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and children. They can have their family back, that they may lead them away and depart.'" You know, we went out, we risked our lives, we rode across the desert short on food and water, we conquered these guys, we took their possessions, we rescued our families, and we do not want to share any of it with them, these people here that didn't help us out. It's an understandable sentiment, I think. And I think for David, had to be tempting to jump on the bandwagon and say, "You know what? I was one of those 400 men that rescued and liberated your families. You challenged my leadership. Well, look what I just accomplished. Why don't you get off my case?" It would have been tempting to go along with these guys. But again, David handles it differently. He says, "No, you must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who's kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us." And he says, "Who will listen to you in this manner? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And so David says, "No, you didn't do anything. Ultimately, it was God's strength and God's guidance and God's power that liberated our families. It's not your spoil, it's the Lord's spoil. And because of that, we will share it with everyone equally, whether they went on this rescue mission or not." And he concludes, it says here that from that day forward, David made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day, that, you know, that the booty or the spoil would be distributed evenly. Okay. What can we learn? What last thing about a crisis can we learn from this? I think the lesson is in the contrast here between the way David and the way his men viewed their success. His men said that we overcame it. His men, when they looked back on the event, attributed their success to themselves. And I don't think we're all that unlike these guys. You know, when we're on the front side of a crisis that we've been through, our tendency is to look back and to minimize what happened and to credit ourselves oftentimes for it turning out well. David, on the other hand, says, he insists, "No, what we're going to do right now is we are going to recognize God and give him credit for what's happened here." And so this is what he did. It says that David gave credit to God. Not an easy thing to do, because it's so tempting to want to boost our own ego. But David stopped and said, "I'm going to give credit to you, Lord." Now, I bet we could bring people up in a room this size, one after another, who can look back on a crisis in your life and say, "God totally brought me through this." I mean, how many people here in this room are even here, period, because of God's strength and power helping us get through things? And I think the lesson here is we've got to not let these things slide by unrecognized, but we've got to drive a stake in the ground right then and say, "Thank you, God. I recognize that you're the one who made this possible." If we don't, we're going to forget, and we're going to not value what God has done in our life. I know about a year and a half ago this spring, my daughter, my wife was pregnant for about 27 weeks, and we lost the baby, and it was obviously traumatic. We knew that this kid was sick well before we lost it, and I can think it's one of the toughest things I've been through in a while. Definitely a crisis. You know, you want to be able to meet that person, you want to see him grow up, and I know for me as a father, I wanted to help him. I wanted to find a way to help him not be sick, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. And it was frustrating. But I can say without bragging, I feel like my wife and I handled that situation with grace and dignity, and we're able to interact with the people involved with that situation with grace and dignity. Not because we're great, obviously, but because people were praying for us. And God is the kind of God that will come to us and give us his strength when we're in a difficult time. I look back on that, and I don't want to ever lose the opportunity that I got from that experience to affirm how good God is and how he's willing to support us if we turn to him. And there's a lot of things in our lives like that, things where something's happened and we've got to get out a piece of paper and write it down or do something to make sure it's burned in our memory that when things are rough, I can turn to God and he's good and he'll deliver. I mean, that's why the Israelites piled stones in the river. God said, I want you to pile stones in this river after you cross into the promised land. I want you to remember how I provided for you. David is very good at this. David in the Psalms says in several places when he reflects on crisis, he says things like this. He says, I love you, God, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress and my deliverer. My God is my rock in whom I take refuge. He's my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call to the Lord who is worthy of praise, and I'm saved from my enemies. That's such a, just, David really had a way of putting his love for God in a way that I can relate to. Every crisis we face is an opportunity to turn to God for strength. And when we watch him come through for us, it's an opportunity to praise him and give him credit for supporting us. And so you look at these things here, just to sum up, how do we handle a crisis? We develop a habit now, before it happens, of strengthening ourselves in God by acknowledging our weakness and spending time with him. We make sure that we inquire of God, ask him, what is it you want me to do about this? And then when things work out, we go ahead and give him credit. And you know, here's one last thing about this. Was David successful in handling this crisis because he got his family back? No, that's not why he was successful. We can never guarantee what the outcome of a crisis is going to be. But what we can guarantee, and what God guarantees, is if we handle our crises in this way, he'll give us the strength to work it out for good. He will get us through it if we can learn to approach it this way. All right, so that's it. Okay, now we're going to continue in this series. Scott was here last week talking about Solomon. Lee Campbell's going to do a teaching on Saul, and it isn't going to be on the pride of life. It's actually going to be more on fear. So if you're fearful or you struggle with fear, this would be a great teaching to come check out. That's next Sunday morning. I would love to pray with y'all for a little bit. So let me start and you can pray a little while and then I'll close up again. All right. God, I thank you for that last point, Lord, that you're sovereign and you know you can look ahead and tell the trajectory that we're headed on is destructive. And in your grace, you curtail that by introducing a low point or whatever it is to get our attention. Thank you that you're that way. And I pray that we could be the kind of people that, like David, are confident that you're good and confident that we can go to you for the strength we need instead of doing it on our own, God.
Father, I think of David and how he knew he was weak. He knew he was needy because he compared himself to you. And I know that in my life, there have been times that I do that and you strengthen me, but there are other times that instead of comparing myself to you, I compare myself to the person next to me or, you know, whoever my competition happens to be for that particular piece of my life. And so I either feel falsely good about myself or I feel hopeless or jealous. Father, I want to ask that you help me to turn to you and to really get it right in who I'm going to compare myself to.
Yeah.
God, I thank you for this reminder today that we're really not in control. We like to think we're in control, but it seems that it takes a crisis to remind us that we're really not. And I just thank you for the situation with David where instead of just kind of crumbling or trying to yank control in a crisis, that he really turns to you first. Because it tells us that we really need to come before you, that we need to align our will with yours so that we can find out how you would have us proceed in a crisis to really find true success.
Lord, I want to thank you, God, for that you desire a personal love relationship with each one of us. Thank you, Lord, in your word where you say that when we are weak, that's where we're strong, Lord. I pray, Lord, that we can take this home with us tonight, Lord, today to lean on you, Lord, and to get our strength from you.
I pray for that too, God. These lessons are hard to carry with us. Seems like we leave them in our chair when we leave a Bible study a lot of times. Help us not be that way. Pray that we could figure out a way to build regular, contentful interaction with you into our schedule. Not in a do it for your approval thing, but do it because we need it. We need you. And I admit, Lord, I'm poor and miserable and blind and naked before you. I need your strength, God. Help me not drift away from that realization as I try to love my kids and be a good husband and serve you, Lord. Amen.